holiday season. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also pleased to have back here on the program once again, David Sineau. He is clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. And once a month, it's always a Friday, he is here and we talk a little bit about investing in money management. And he begins by making a few comments. As I said before the news, occasionally he talks a little bit about the economy. Sometimes it's some very specific topic that he has in mind. Recently, he's has talked on and off about his now famous couch potato portfolio, where he has picked a kind of an allocation for mutual funds, a selection of mutual funds, and has been reporting on how those things have been doing. So he has a few things here to say, and we'll do that to start out. But then when we get to the point of questions, you can ask if you want to ask a question about something that he has discussed here in his remarks, that's fine, or anything else that has to do with financial planning and money management. And we've talked about a lot of things for people who want to make sure they have money to send their kids to college, and particularly people who are thinking about their retirement. So any and all of that is certainly fine. And welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And of course, let me take this opportunity to wish all of the listeners of WILL a very joyous holiday season. Well, David, you took the thunder away from me. I guess I'll begin with the couch potato portfolio and its performance for the year, at least through yesterday's close. Now, you'll recall that this portfolio consists of 8 asset classes or index funds. These particular funds or indexes are accessed through Vanguard, but many of these indexes, of course, are available through other providers as well. Let me quickly review the asset allocation of the portfolio. You may recall that we have 10% of our dollar, 10 cents of our dollar, in the S&P 500, 15 cents of our dollar in the large value play, the large value index, 10% in small companies, often referred to as the Russell 2000, 15 cents of our dollar in something called small company value. We take the smaller companies and we look for the value plays in those smaller companies, typically companies that are selling on the cheap, either price to earnings or price to book. We have 10% of our money allocated in the mid caps. So if we take the great big 500 companies, we subtract out the 100 of those, and we simply invest in the remaining 400. That's called the mid-cap class. 10% in real estate through a real estate investment trust, and then the remaining 30% in the international sector. We take 20 cents of our dollar and put it in something called the Total International Index. That's really companies all over the world, some of the major companies from Europe, Australia, the Far East, and other parts of the world as well. And finally, smaller companies, often referred to as the emerging markets or emerging companies within those markets, 10% of the portfolio. Well, at least through yesterday's close, including reinvestment of dividends, the portfolio has surged ahead. I'm at least proud to present you with a 12.39% rate of return for the year. And that return is almost twice the gain of the S&P 500 for the year. And as I mentioned earlier, the S&P 500, well, it's ahead about 6.5% for the year. So bottom line, it really does pay to diversify. But let me provide you with some more specific examples. The international markets this year have really outperformed the U.S. markets by a significant amount. For example, the Total International Index is up more than 14% for the year, and emerging markets is ahead more than 28% for the year. Now, in contradistinction, the Russell 2000, as I mentioned, commonly referred to as the U.S. Small Cap Index, is ahead about 8.5% for the year, so it's really lagging our overall portfolio. Now, here's something really important to remember. At the end of every 12 months, it's important to rebalance your portfolio back to its original asset allocation. Let me give you an example. As I said, the emerging markets index has surged almost 29% for the year. Yet in our couch potato portfolio, only 10% of the overall value of the portfolio is to be invested in emerging markets. So therefore, at the end of the year, it would be necessary to sell a certain number of shares in this particular asset class or index and reposition that money in some of the other asset classes to bring the portfolio back into its original asset allocation balance. Now, I prefer rebalancing portfolios in early January after at least 1 year has passed. By waiting a full year, any gain that I realize by selling is treated as a capital gain rather than ordinary income, thereby, of course, saving taxes. Furthermore, academic studies have shown that for the average investor like myself, there is really a negligible difference between rebalancing once per year as opposed to some people who insist on rebalancing quarterly or even perhaps monthly. That's just too much work, too much trouble, too many transactions. I'm just too busy to do that, and there just simply isn't a negligible difference. So bottom line, once a year, starting in January, rebalance that portfolio so we get back in line with our original asset allocation. And of course, any assets that are sold or repositioned, which are inside an IRA, a 401k, or other retirement program, entirely avoid current taxation because you really are operating in a tax-deferred or, in some cases, a tax-free environment. And in fact, many retirement programs now offer direct computer access to rebalancing your portfolio. Employers and sponsors of retirement programs are now recognizing the importance of this investment technique. So, rebalance once a year. I'd like to switch topics for just a moment. Throughout the year, clients, many friends, and even students are constantly asking me to recommend books that will improve their business or investment skills or acumen. Now, given the holiday season, I believe any of the following books would be very much appreciated by friends, relatives, students, etc. And all of the books that I'm going to recommend are available in bookstores or via the internet. I checked their availability through Amazon.com just last night, and most could be purchased new or used. Typically, I purchase them used, to be honest about it, because I don't need the fancy new covers, but in any event, they generally are available in bookstores or across the internet. Number one choice, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. It's a classic, ladies and gentlemen. It's been around forever. I don't know if it's in its 12th reprinting, 25th reprinting, but it's sold literally millions and millions of copies. It's really a book about psychology. It's really a book about how to improve your communication skills, your leadership skills, your group dynamic skills, and how you can build a team and want those team members to work for you if you find yourself in a business setting. It's just a tremendous read. As I said, it's a psychology book more than even a business book. It's a communications book more than a business book. And it's my number one choice for any student in college who is going to go out in the real world, so to speak, obtain a career position, and they are immediately going to be thrust into typically a teamwork type position. How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie. Next on my list, Negotiate to Close by Gary Karas. Karas is spelled K-A-R-A-S-S. A great book. It's a book about how to negotiate. Not only negotiating in business, negotiating in life with your friends, your colleagues. Even, frankly, probably it can be applied to your marriage as well. It's the art and science of intelligent negotiation where both parties walk away from the negotiation feeling reasonably good about that negotiation interaction. Another great read. Something well known in the marketplace, it's called Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, K-I-Y-O-S-A-K-I. Kiyosaki really has a series of books out. I really like this one. All of these are easy to understand. They're very straightforward. And Kiyosaki talks about the difference between who gets rich and who gets poor. It has nothing to do with academic ability. It has something to do with understanding the difference between an asset and a liability. And without getting hung up in fancy financial statements, here's the bottom line. Assets generate cash. Liabilities cost money. Your job is to obtain, attract, and accumulate assets. And the sooner you start on that road And the sooner that you get rid of cash liabilities, things that cost you money, the better off you're going to be. And it's really a very easy book to read, a fun read, and I highly recommend it. The Millionaire Next Door. It's a classic by Thomas Stanley. What does it teach? Well, there's lots and lots of very, very quiet millionaires out there, just more than we can ever imagine. And most of them got that way because they worked hard and they spent below their means. That was the real reason. They saved and they spent less. They were not copious consumers. And to the extent they did consume, they always had additional revenue left over for investment. That's The Millionaire Next Door. The Situational Leader by Paul Hersey. Again, another great psychology read, a must for anyone who finds themselves or aspires to be a leader in an organization. And leadership depends upon understanding situations, understanding environments, and understanding all of the actors in that environment. Just 130 pages. It's a couple-hour read. I've read it three or four times. Every time I go back to it, I get something new out of it. On a lighter note, Where Are the Customer's Yachts? How do you like that title? Where Are the Customer's Yachts by Fred Schwed Jr., S-C-H-W-E-D. Mr. Schwed basically says, well, the customers who invest with the brokers don't have very many yachts. The people who have the yachts are the brokers living in New York and are on Wall Street because they seem to end up with the money, typically not the investors. So it's a walk down Wall Street. It's a story of Wall Street. It tells you about who gets rich, who doesn't get rich, and why. And finally, something just a little bit more academic but very easy to read, a great bedside read, The Wall Street Journal Guide to Understanding Money and Investing. It's in its third edition, The Wall Street Journal Guide. It actually has a number of different books, but Guide to Understanding Money and Investing by Morris and Morris. These people are not typical business people. That they are writers, they are journalists, and they have taken complex financial subjects and reduced them to something anyone can understand and discern. It's a book about stocks, bonds, securities, mutual funds, options. It tells you it's a veritable menu of all of these financial securities and techniques. A great read and certainly a worthwhile read for any student at the university. So that's my book list. And if you're still looking for something to give that someone special or a student or a friend, etc., I think any of those books would be excellent choices. Well, in addition to purchasing gifts, I think December is a time of reconsidering savings and reconsidering investment choices. And for many of us and for our children, the optimum savings vehicle, at least today, and one that is simple to understand, is the Roth IRA. And it's a good time of the year to strongly consider funding a Roth IRA, either for yourself or maybe for a loved one who has earned income. Now, in order to be eligible to contribute to a Roth, remember that an individual must generate earned income. So it's somebody who's working, somebody who is either self-employed or is an employee and has one of those W-2s at the end of the year. Interest income, dividend income, rental income is not the kind of income that makes you eligible for a Roth IRA. And of course, there are limits to the people who can participate and establish or continue to contribute to a Roth IRA. If you are single and you are fortunate enough to earn more than $95,000 per year, well, you're not eligible for a Roth IRA. And if you're married and you earn more than $150,000 a year, you too are not eligible to continue to contribute to Roth IRAs. Now, the 2005 contribution limits are typically $4,000. And if you're an old person like myself, that means someone over 50, then you have a catch-up provision and you actually contribute as much as $5,000 annually to your Roth IRA. And in 2006, the initial contribution remains at $4,000, but it moves up to $5,000 if you are over 50. Contributions can be made all the way up to April 15th of 2006 to establish a 2005 IRA, or the date that you file your income tax return, whichever is first. So you could fund your 2005 in 2006, and you could also go ahead and fund a 2006. At the same time, if you found yourself fortunate enough to have those kinds of investment proceeds available. The beauty of a Roth, of course, is the fact that all of your earnings compound tax-free so long as you wait until at least 59 and a half to access your funds. Now, here's something also important, and this is a very good reason to start a Roth IRA when you are young, for a child, for example. Because once the IRA has been in existence for 5 years, $10,000 of earnings, that's earnings, not contributions, but $10,000 of earnings can be withdrawn at any time, totally tax-free, if these earnings are used toward the purchase of a first home. And for that matter, you can also withdraw your original contributions and use them as well to fund a first-time home purchase, no tax. But again, you've got to start early with that Roth IRA, maybe 17, 18, 19. So maybe when you're 24, 25 and you're looking at that first purchase, you can say, golly gee, my Roth IRA has been around for 5 years. I've got some earnings in that Roth IRA. I can pull them out entirely tax-free and utilize them toward a down payment on a house. And finally, in a Roth IRA, if you find yourself in this enviable position, you never have to pull money out of your Roth IRA. Unlike a regular retirement program where typically once you hit the magic age of 70 and a half, you have minimum distributions, that is not the case with a Roth IRA. You can leave those funds to a beneficiary at your demise, and they thereby avoid probate as well. Lots of good reasons to start investing in a Roth IRA. Lots of good reasons to start early. Many, many different choices. Brokerage firms, mutual funds, banks, all are plan providers, and they offer opportunities to invest in any way that you see fit. Well, there you kind of have it, David, this morning. I'd be delighted to further explore the issues I've raised or, of course, tackle any questions of our listeners.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. And once a month, always on a Friday in the 10 o'clock hour, he is here to do this program with us. And the idea is that it's a kind of a nuts and bolts, informational-oriented thing. If you have particular questions about your own situation and you're not quite sure what to do, this would be one place to get some advice. You can give us a call. Also, we had someone who wanted to hear again the titles of the books. And rather than take time to do that right at this moment, because we have some callers, if it would be okay with you, one thing we could do was we could take it and we could put it on our website. So if people have internet access, they can get it. And otherwise, if people would just drop us a line, we can always print off a copy and send it to folks who are listening.
Be pleased to have that added to the internet.
All right. Let's go to Moultrie County for our first caller. Here, line number one. Hello.
I have a very general question. We hear and read a lot about the savings rate, how it's low in this country and high in Japan and so forth. But I don't know what exactly is included in savings. Specifically, if you have a CD and you reinvest the interest, or if you have a mutual fund and you reinvest the dividends and capital gains, do they count that as part of savings, or is it just wage and business income?
Well, it's really interesting. Here's what the savings rate does not include. It does not include equity in your home. So every month that you are paying down your mortgage, for example, that's not included in the savings rate, nor is the inflationary gain, which has been tremendous, at least in certain parts of the country, part of your savings. Typically, the amounts of money in a retirement plan, all right, that's not considered part of the national savings rate, at least for the employer portion of those monies that are going into a savings plan. Bottom line, the savings rate in the United States unquestionably is understated. That's really what I can tell you. Now, obviously, when you take cash flow from your earnings and you invest those yourself, that is part of the savings rate.
Mm-hmm. But if the dividends, capital gains from a mutual fund, do they put that in there or not?
Well, to the extent that you reflect that on your tax return, the answer is yes.
Okay. All right.
Does that help you out?
Yes, it does.
Okay, a pleasure talking with you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go next to someone here listening in Charleston, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Sinnoh. Hey, I did not catch the asset allocation model that you referred to, but before I ask you for that, I'm almost 65, I'm retired, and my financial advisor says I should be keeping roughly half of my portfolio in fixed income and cash and the other half in equity. Now, I was wondering if this asset allocation portfolio you're talking about applies just to the equity side, or does it apply to the whole portfolio?
That's a great question. I think that we'll go ahead and just post that couch potato as well, because I think so many people have asked about it. So when we post the actual books that I'm recommending, we'll post that asset allocation as well. You've raised a great question. The couch potato portfolio only refers to that amount of money that you are willing to devote to equities.
That's right.
So if you are balanced 50-50, which I have no problem with at age 65, then that 50% that you have in equities, the couch potato is one potential investment choice with that 50%. Regardless of how you have that 50% allocated in equities, the question that you should be asking your financial advisor is the following. One, what is the mean, M-E-A-N, expected return on my equity portfolio? That would be a question that I would ask. In other words, given this portfolio over the last number of years, how has it done? How's it done? Has it done 4%, 8%, 12% over a good number of years? And the second question, at least to one standard deviation, what's the range of returns I should expect on my equity portfolio? In other words, at least about two-thirds of the time, every 10 years, about 65% or 70% of the time, say 6 to 7 years, what's the range of returns I should expect? So if my mean return is 8%, that would be the average return, what's the volatility I'm looking at? Maybe will I have a year where I might make 20? Is there a possibility I might lose 20? And that's a better way of looking at an equity portfolio, is what is the range that we would expect in the equity portfolio that we're currently in?
Last question. I have my house paid off, and I have full equity in it, of course. How should I mix that into my overall portfolio, or should I bother doing it?
Well, obviously, it's a real estate asset. Kudos to anyone who is either retired or 65 and has their house paid off. Number one, don't go back in and mortgage it thinking you're going to get some better rates of return elsewhere. I'm generally against that, especially for people in retirement. The point that I would make is that for most people, it should sort of not be considered as part of your investment portfolio. About the only time that I would consider it is if I was in a rapidly appreciating asset or in a part of a country where I have a rapidly appreciating real estate, then I might have less money in my securitized investments like a real estate investment trust. So if I already have a substantial amount of my net worth in real estate, there really isn't a good reason that I should be spending another 10% of my money in real estate investments through securities. So that's how I would consider it in light of where I have my other investments.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have a couple of other people here. We'll get right to them. Let me just introduce again our guest. David Sinnoh is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. In the first hour, we talk about personal finance and money management. And if you have investing questions or you're thinking about your own particular financial strategy and you'd like to get a little advice, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is in Champaign and on line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David.
Mm-hmm. Hi there.
Hi, I've been wanting to ask you for the longest time. I'm in the self-managed plan at the university, and through Fidelity Investments, I'm able to get a very narrow kind of options. And for instance, they don't have small cap value, they don't have mid cap, and they don't have emerging market index. And I was going to ask you if, since they don't have an emerging market index, just to go 40% international then, on the international index that they have, and maybe what to do with these other funds to get them diversified.
Well, have you gone to Fidelity Screen and called them up? They don't have pure indexes, but they have some mutual funds that are actively managed that sort of try to look at some of these areas. Now, it's not a pure index fund. So have you gone to your screens and called up Small Value and looked at them and,
yes,
and International?
Yes, that is not offered. There's only like maybe 8 to 10 different funds that are
offered. Oh, that are offered through Fidelity in the self-managed program. You don't have access, for example, as we do through the 403B
exactly.
at the University of Illinois.
Exactly. Mm. So that's where I'm limited to. And just one more question before I go. I plan on getting an advanced degree.
Yes.
And then going back into the university system. I would have to sit down with an advisor probably just to figure out if I wanted to stick with the self-managed plan or go to the defined benefit. But
yes, and I'm not certain what that rule is after you leave the university and then come back, whether you can switch back into a DB plan. That's a question for the CSRS people. It's just not an area that I'm cognizant of, so I would be loath to give you advice in that area. In the meantime, though, you do have the option of looking at other choices in the self-management plan. For example, you can look at some of the CREF choices and the CREF International choices. Have you looked at those?
Yes, yes, but I looked at Fidelity compared to CREF, and they just have more choices.
Yeah, they do. If you feel more comfortable with the choices,
and
that's for certain.
And like you say, it's easier just to keep it simplified.
Okay. Now, in terms of an asset allocation, 40% internationally right now, maybe a little steep. I'd feel more comfortable in the 30% range.
Okay, because another good book I've just recently read is The Future for Investors.
Yes.
And they recommend pretty soon that people should invest 40% international because that's where the growth is eventually.
Well, I'm not disagreeing other than everybody's rushing into international. Everybody's rushing into it.
And when everybody
rushes. It's the old story, you know, when everyone rushes into something, that's when that asset class is going to slow down.
And that's when the large cap companies look good again.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So I'm a little concerned with new money. If with old money, maybe you can sit, but with new money, maybe just back that off just a bit.
So you're comfortable with 30% international?
Absolutely. That's my portfolio, so I'm comfortable with it.
Hey, thanks, David.
My pleasure. Right,
thanks for the call. Next is Urbana and line one. Hello.
Is this me?
Yes.
Great. Yes, I'm going. This isn't investment directly. It's just I expect to be within 6 months or so in an opportunity to invest. It's regarding inheritance. Now, the estate in question is less than the $1.5 million cap.
Okay.
So there's no tax on the estate itself. Question
Correct.
Is, if I get half of this big lump of money, does it count as, do I have a tax liability myself as earned income or something like that?
Well, it depends on the kind of asset that you're receiving.
It is all mutual funds and CDs.
Okay. And are those any of those mutual funds or CDs inside an IRA?
Yes.
So you're going to be receiving IRA funds.
Okay.
All right. If you are, before you take any IRA funds, you want to find out, first of all, whether this is a Roth IRA.
These are all set up before the Roth.
Okay, so these are traditional IRAs. Now, you have some choices to make and, more importantly, are making good choices as opposed to worrying about the investment itself.
Right.
There are three different ways to handle IRAs when you are the beneficiary of an inherited IRA. Number one, that money can be just provided to you directly, and to the extent any money is provided to you directly and you just take it, then you're going to be 100% taxed at ordinary income tax rates on those IRAs. That's not a good choice, typically.
All right.
So, in other words, let's just say that that number is $300,000 that are in IRA funds that would come to you.
Okay.
If you just have them rolled over and just paid to you as a beneficiary, just outright, so they are now in your name, that $300,000 is immediately taxable. And trust me, the tax on that would be at least at the 35%.
Correct.
Federal tax rate. That's a bad choice.
All right.
A second choice is to take the money over 5 years, 1/5, 1/4, 1/3, 1/2, 1/1. So you start taking the money in the next year by December after the year of the decedent. So this person that your family, that member died this year?
Yes.
Okay. So that money would possibly then a choice would be to take it under what's called an inherited IRA, and your first payment would be taken in 2006. One-fifth of the balance as of December 31 would be taken in 2006, then one-fourth, one-third, one-half, one-over-one. That also then means that the money, to the extent you receive it, will be taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So you're averaging, if you will,
okay,
in that particular choice. But there is a third choice, and it is often the best choice, and that is that you are able to make an election and take the money over your actuarial life expectancy. So how old are you now?
53.
53, all right. I'm just guessing that based upon IRS actuarial tables, that puts you in the 80s, maybe 85. So you would then be taking this money over the next 32 years, 1/32, 1/31, 1 over 30, 1 over 29. So in this way, this money would continue to grow, if you will, in early years and provide you still with income. And to the extent that you take the income, of course, it's taxable. Now,
right,
here's something important. How many of there are you? How many beneficiaries
Two.
Are there? Two. And were these IRAs split before death, or was it just one IRA naming two beneficiaries?
I don't know if even beneficiaries were named.
Okay. So you need to check with your tax advisor and your lawyer, but typically, to the extent that you are a beneficiary and another sibling, for example, is a beneficiary, generally, if the IRA has not been split, you need to make the same election.
Okay.
So if one of you wanted to take it all in cash, that may preclude you from doing it over your actuarial life expectancy. So find out, number one, before you take any money, what are my choices? Are all three choices available to me depending upon how the IRA was set up? And if so, can we, the two of us as beneficiaries, agree on how we should take this money?
Okay. Now, does what you say apply only to IRAs? Like there's about half of it is in...
Yep. Yep.
Okay, so
yep.
About half of it is in CDs and ordinary mutual funds.
No, that's completely different. You'll take that totally tax-free, and then once it's yours, to the extent that you reinvest it and it starts generating interest or dividends, then that interest or dividends is subject to tax.
Okay, so it's only the IRAs that are subject to tax.
That's the big one you want to work on, so don't take any money until
right.
You've got that
glad
worked out.
Because I was thinking if it all came with one lump sum, I was going to put most of it into buying a house. But if I suddenly found myself with a $150,000 tax bill, you can...
You bet. So
okay.
Get that solved first.
Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right, thank
Goodbye.
You. Let's continue. And the next caller is also in Urbana and line 3. Hello.
Hello. I had a question. My husband had a maiden aunt that just passed away, and he's the sole beneficiary, and he's named on all the annuities that she had. And I understand that you have to know what was initially paid in against the value because that's taxable. But there seems to be different options that the companies give you for what you can do with an annuity.
Yes, there are a number of choices.
Is there any choice that is the best, you know, or does it depend on circumstances?
Well, it does depend on circumstances, but let me give you some touchstones first of all. Now, the money will be coming to your husband because he is the named beneficiary of those annuities.
Mm-hmm.
And you are quite right that what has to be determined is how much money did the original annuitant put into that annuity. Let's say the original annuitant, your maiden aunt, put $10,000 into an annuity. And now that annuity is worth $20,000 and your husband is the beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
That difference, or $10,000 between the current market value and what your maiden aunt put in, that is taxable income. That
mm-hmm.
will be taxed to your husband if, for example, he just takes the $20,000 as a check and then simply reinvests it himself.
Mm-hmm.
The only beneficiary that is not subject to taxable income would be a surviving spouse. So, for
right.
example, if the maiden aunt left an uncle, then and the uncle was the beneficiary, then that would pass to the uncle and there would be no immediate tax on that. All right,
mm-hmm.
but if you take it as a lump sum, you have to know the basis and now the market value, and that difference will be subject to ordinary income tax, and it will be added simply to your income tax return, and it will kick you into whatever marginal rate you find yourself in. Mm-hmm. So clearly you will be paying it on the highest marginal rate. Since insurance companies know this, what they suggest to you is annuitizing it over a period of time so that you get an annuitized payment, and a portion of it is a return of principal, part of which is taxable based upon this basis question, and mm-hmm. part of it is interest, which is also taxable. So it ameliorates the impact of the taxes. However, it is important to understand at what interest rate you are receiving these annuity payments. So you would need to either be able to do that yourself on a financial calculator or go to a financial advisor who can say, based upon these choices, here's the actual interest that they are willing to pay me over the next series of years while I annuitize this benefit.
Yeah, now, I think they give you 5 years as the option.
They give you a 5-year option under this particular contract. And if you know the beginning value, if you know the monthly annuity payment and you know the period of time, which is 60 months, you can determine an imputed interest rate. It's really very easy to do on a financial calculator. Your accountant or someone could help you with that and tell you exactly what's the insurance company really paying me. And I think you're going to find it's a very, very low rate of interest, somewhere between 2.5% and typically 3.5%.
Okay.
So it may well be, when everything is said and done, is to take the money, pay the income tax, and reinvest it yourself at a higher rate. That's what you have to be looking at, and you need some financial help, unless you're good at that yourself, to make that determination. But it's a very typical question. It's a great question, and literally hundreds of thousands of Americans every year are faced with your very issue.
I had another brief question, and that was that currently we have some investments with Northern Trust and Ameriprise, but with the amount of his aunt's estate, we sort of have a choice where we plant it. And we didn't know how you go about comparison shopping for where to invest.
Well, are you
what the best strategy is?
Do you currently have an account at Northern Trust?
There's a trust account. We don't have any investment accounts.
So Northern Trust was named as a trustee.
Correct.
Of an account, and they would then manage the money.
Correct.
Well, I'm very high on Northern Trust. I think they do a very good job. I think there are any number of people locally in Champaign-Urbana that are also in the professional money management business, and I would urge you to talk to at least 3 or 4. I would want to know specifically what are their expenses.
Mm-hmm.
For managing the money. And then number 2, what type of investment strategy would they recommend given your particular circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things that you would need to investigate. It's a big question. It takes some time, some research on your part.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do your research and your homework, I'm sure it will turn out. The positive news, of course, is that you now have these funds to deal with. And, of course, it's a new responsibility as well.
Right, and it falls on me because my husband leaves me to manage the money. So.
Well, there you go. You're probably good at it. If you don't know what to do with it.
I'm better than he is.
Okay,
but,
now, if you don't know what to do with it, I have 2 daughters who need money. Okay, so I accept gifts from listeners. Okay, don't call it charity because it won't be written off. But I will accept it. So have a conversation with Northern. Have a conversation with a number of local institutions. We're blessed in Champaign-Urbana with a number of local institutions who have very, very good abilities in the money management field.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We got about 15 minutes left here. David Sinnoh is our guest. He is a clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois. Once a month he's on this program. We talk about money management, and questions are welcome. We have several people waiting and ready to go, and we'll see if we can help you out. You've been working on this Sinnoh Girls College Fund now for
years.
Have you gotten any contributions?
No, David, and it's very disappointing.
Oh,
in fact, it's bordering on distressful.
Well, that's because they've all been sending their money to the David Inge Retirement Fund as if. Let's go on here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, my question, thank you for taking my call, first of all. My question is concerning group supplemental retirement money and converting that to Roth IRA. And my understanding is that at age 59 and a half, I can take money out of my group supplemental retirement account, pay the taxes on it at that time, and then put that into a Roth. And my question is there an advantage to doing that?
You know, you have me a little bit stumped on that. Can you tell me about where you have this group supplemental retirement program?
It's with the University of Illinois.
Oh, all right. All right. So you have a supplemental retirement program.
Right.
And you could essentially roll that into an IRA and then pay the tax and roll it to a Roth. That's really
I have to roll it to a traditional firm.
Yes, it's a two-step process.
Yeah,
I was wondering what kind of vehicle allowed you to go directly to a Roth, and I said, that's a new one.
No, I forgot that step.
Okay, so that's really a question, and I can't answer that question without knowing a little bit more about your tax situation, but typically, if you have a reasonable life expectancy in your family, mm-hmm. all right, if you believe that people in your family and most people who reach 59 and a half have at least a 50% chance of reaching 80,
right.
all right, if you don't have some reason to believe that you're not going to fall in that life expectancy and you find yourself in not the highest tax bracket but a reasonable income tax bracket, then typically, if you are willing to hold on for the long period, you will actually be better off in the Roth IRA.
Right.
All right?
That's
the mathematics of it. I've done some present value analysis with some students and looked at that pretty carefully. And again, it's an issue of time and it's an issue of income tax bracket. Now,
right.
keep in mind that in order to ameliorate the impact of that income tax bracket, once you roll to your traditional IRA, that's a tax-free event, tax-deferred event, actually.
Okay.
You're not paying tax then. It's only when you roll to the Roth that you're going to be paying tax. Follow that?
Uh-huh.
Now, you don't have to roll all that money at once. So you could do that over a period of time to see whether or not that would reduce the income tax impact so you don't move to a higher bracket.
Yeah. In fact, I'd have to do that because I'd want to roll over as much as I could based on my expectation of living a very long time, possibly forever.
Okay. But the period of time that you roll it over, you don't have to do that all in 1 year.
Right.
You could do that over a series of years so you don't suddenly move up to a higher income tax bracket.
Right.
I think you're on the right track.
Good. My second question is concerning home mortgage and paying off your home mortgage before retirement, which I've been told is really desirable, but I've been reading a lot of the magazines, money magazines and things like that. And some of the articles are saying, well, that may not be such a good deal because then you lose that home mortgage interest deduction. And when you're in retirement, a lot of people are retiring at the same income they were earning. And so losing that home mortgage deduction, actually, they end up paying more taxes.
I've never bought into that argument. I think it's, to be honest about it, I think it's a ridiculous argument. Here's my point. Let's say that you have an $800 a month mortgage payment, and $600 of it is interest. Just say that. Or let's make it easier, $500 is interest. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And people say, I need to have that mortgage payment because I get a $500 interest deduction. Well, a lot of people, number one, don't itemize. And even if they do itemize, maybe that $500 a month times 12 is $6,000, and maybe they're in a 25% bracket, so they save $1,500 of tax, okay?
Right.
Or they're saving $125 a month. I'd much rather have the cash flow of $800 than saving my $125 a month, and then I would be able to invest my entire $800. And furthermore, most clients that I see in retirement are much happier if they are not looking at a mortgage payment every month.
Yeah.
So I don't really buy into that argument. Now, maybe in California, if you're in a 35% tax bracket and you have a large mortgage and it's a cheap mortgage, maybe then, because of the interest write-off, it makes more sense. But typically not in Central Illinois.
Thank you very much. This is a great show.
Well, thanks for the call. Glad we could help you out. And we will continue here. We have about 7-8 minutes left. We have some other callers. Next, we will talk with someone in Mahomet on cell phone. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I want to return to the question of inheritance. I've come into an eight-figure inheritance that's been set up in the form of trusts, half being a non-GST trust, the other half being a GST trust.
Yes.
And I've got a financial advisor here, and I've also got an accountant here. And this money is being managed. I have no control over who manages it or what they do with it. This is the way this was set up.
Okay.
And
are you the only beneficiary?
No, there's someone of mine. It's yes. I mean, there's another beneficiary. They got half of the money.
So they have another GST trust also, and another non-GST revocable trust. Okay.
Right. It doesn't affect my trust at all.
Okay.
But the thing is, my accountant immediately told them that he wanted monthly statements of what they were doing to make sure that there was no churning going on.
Yes.
But I was just talking to someone yesterday, and he said, remember, I can't say anything at all about what they do with their money. I just don't have any input. And he said there's lots of other ways that they basically can just deplete the trust, which are legal. And how do I watch out to see if that's happening?
Let me ask you a question. Number one, do you have copies of the trust? Do you have copies of the legal documents? As a beneficiary,
yes. You
have the right to copies of the legal document.
We have that.
Do you have the ability? Do you have any rights under the legal document? For example, if you are unhappy with the trustee, to change trustees?
No.
That is unfortunate. When people draw trusts, when the beneficiary can't get along with a trustee, the beneficiary should be empowered to at least be able to choose another corporate trustee based upon some criteria. Okay? Now, so there are no rights that you have under the trust.
Right.
Okay? But regardless, they have fiduciary responsibilities to you. Those fiduciary responsibilities include careful stewardship of the trust, working in your best interest since you are the beneficiary.
Yes.
So they need to know what your interests are and what your health, education, welfare, and maintenance needs are. So that requires interaction with you. It also requires them reporting to you on a regular basis under fiduciary rules and regulations, and to take all due care not to dissipate the trust or charge inordinate expenses against the trust.
Mm-hmm.
So while you may not have any investment choices, under the laws you are protected. Was this trust set up in Illinois?
No, it's in Pennsylvania.
So it's a Pennsylvania trust. What you have is you have something called a Pennsylvania Legacy Trust, and you have a Pennsylvania Irrevocable Trust. And now we would have to look at the laws in Pennsylvania. Is it a Pennsylvania corporate trustee as well? Is the trustee located in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Okay. So you would need, if you are unhappy with the way things are going, and it's not clear that you know, they're not doing a good job, you would probably need, given your financial circumstances, you probably could afford to visit with someone who is an expert in Pennsylvania on Pennsylvania trust law to see specifically what rights that you have and how to protect yourself.
Right. Let me give you two specific cases. I asked if they it says in the trust that they can pay for health costs if needed. They can. It's up to them to decide.
Yes.
So I said, well, will you pay? I pay $2,300 a year for extended care.
Yes.
Insurance. I said, will you pay for that? And they said, we'll certainly consider paying for it.
Here's the way it works.
Here's
the way it works. You submit bills, they take them to a trust committee, they look at the trust document, and they make a decision. If they're smart, they'll pay them.
Yeah.
Because then you're happy.
Right.
If they're not smart, because they think they want to have more money in the trust so they can bill more, that's probably short-sighted.
In the second case, the second thing is when I die, that the money left in the trust goes to other people.
Right.
And they said that they have to make their investments so that there is money left in the trust for when I die for these secondary people. And I said, Why?
Well, that's the case. That is the case, that there has to be some equity allocation, because a trustee exercising due care must take into consideration not only the initial beneficiary but the remainder beneficiaries, and they don't want to get sued by the remainder beneficiaries for saying all you did is buy CDs and generate income and give it to this beneficiary. Why didn't you have some money in the stock market, which has the long-term returns much higher than fixed income? I know we got to jump here, so my advice is to get yourself a good attorney who understands these issues. And you're welcome to talk to me off the air.
And I think pretty much we're going to have to stop for this time around. And I'm sorry, we have a couple of people that we cannot take. Dave will be back again next month. We have got the books that he mentioned at the beginning of the program, all except I think there's one title we weren't sure about. We'll get that taken care of. That's on the website. We can also get his Couch Potato portfolio. We can put that on there. Actually, also a while back, you gave a really nice list about things to do if you're concerned about identity theft.
And I think that was put on the
web.
That was put on the web.
Good. Well, I was going to say, if it wasn't, we should get that on there too. All three of these things, really nice pieces of information. So you can go to our website, will.uiuc.edu. Look on the Focus 580 section and you will find that there. In the meantime, we'll say that Dave will be back again next month, which will then be next year.
Next year, we'll be older,
Dave. Well, you bet. And we'll do this all over again. Dave is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. As always, good to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925, Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. A little later today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll explore a little-known chapter in the life of Theodore Roosevelt. Now, when you think about Teddy Roosevelt, there may be a number of images that come to mind. Mount Rushmore, his progressive politics, the fact that he helped create the National Park System. There was the Panama Canal. There's even the teddy bear. But there are a lot of people that are not aware that one of his most remarkable achievements was descending and mapping a tributary of the Amazon. On the program today, Celeste Quinn will be talking with Candace Millard, author of a new book that tells the story. The book is entitled The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey. And you can hear that in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Celeste Quinn is the host. We're going to take a break. As we usually do, we'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the commodity markets, so please stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the Chicago Board of Trade and Kansas City Exchanges. Soybeans